the voluntary city, choice, community and civil society. Introduction. The fall of the Berlin Wall and the demise of socialism hastened intellectual realignments and rediscovery of the virtues of free markets. Many on the left and the right now agree that markets provide best. This view focuses attention on the supporting institutions that are necessary for the material progress of both developed and developing nations. For markets to succeed, a working legal infrastructure, including traditions of lawfulness, a greater reliance on evolving common law over statutory law, and high levels of trust must be in place. Beyond exploring intellectual shifts, however, it is important to examine carefully what people do and have always done as they strive to manage their everyday lives. Long before government institutions emerged as the definitive purveyors of institutions and social services, private citizens developed a variety of institutions that served the public welfare. Regardless of whether the current worldview emphasizes the merits of top-down planning or bottom-up action, the latter has always been consequential. The retreat of socialism and progressivism, and other manifestations of the industrial counter-revolution, has brought a new appreciation of spontaneous orders, but the important fact is that these have always been there. Without black markets, for example, the communist states would have succumbed much sooner and many third world countries would be even poorer. We have come full circle. Accordingly, we are well advised to examine the power of bottom-up innovation in shaping human events now as well as in recent history. The authors of the Voluntary City document some of the most important episodes. They prompt questions for the next great debates. Markets may be necessary for material progress, but are they sufficient? What exactly do we mean by progress? Can market economies protect workers from economic downturns? Can they provide for the downtrodden and unfortunate? What about non-material progress? Can markets be equitable? Can a market society develop community? Markets, voluntarism, non-profits, and civil society. While recent accounts such as Putnam's Bowling Alone suggest a no to the last question, the contributors to TVC suggest that the scope for markets is much wider than is usually recognized. The authors discuss examples of voluntary and contractual arrangements that also develop communities and deliver social services. These are shown to thrive on working legal infrastructures and social trust. If so, there exists a very significant virtuous cycle. Markets beget the institutions and organizations which, in turn, promote markets. The latter spur innovation, entrepreneurship and progress, which create the demand for the economic freedoms that beget more riches. Liberty and prosperity expand along the way. Some of the evidence comes from a rediscovery of the history of voluntarism and social services, including the remarkable history of fraternal orders and friendly societies in 19th century America and Great Britain. These provided members with medical care, unemployment insurance, sickness insurance, and many other social services. TVC studies illustrate that the authors do not have a blinkered view of either markets or human nature. With respect to markets, they call attention to the vital, but too often neglected, role of the non-profit sector. Proponents of markets view the profit-maximizing firm as an ideal and the attenuation of profit incentives an unwelcome divergence. Proponents of government, while more supportive of non-profits, have tended to see the non-profit sector as weak, frail and marginal. Yet, the non-profit sector in the United States today accounts for some 10% of GDP and nearly 15% of total employment. It is a major player in such important industries as health, education, and high culture. It was important in these industries long before receiving tax breaks or regulatory advantages. Non-profits and the market both involve voluntary action. By focusing on for-profit firms, proponents of markets have often overstated the case for markets narrowly conceived. Yet by ignoring the role of non-profits, opponents of markets have understated the case for markets broadly conceived. What conventional economics refers to as market failure is actually a limited set of problems associated with for-profit firms. In TVC, the term market is broadened to include non-profit firms and other voluntary, not-for-profit organizations. The scope of market failure is diminished. Thus, Rather than arguing for a larger role for markets, the authors argue for a larger role for civil society. To favor civil society is not necessarily to regard self-interest as the sole or even most important motivator of human action. The market government debate has often proceeded as if it were a debate between self-interest and selflessness. Yet we now know that our ancestors learned to forge connections and developed a social nature for the practical reason that such connections enhanced survival, just as did their capacity for self-interest. Humans are neither purely self-interested nor purely altruistic. It should come as no surprise that other regarding this is not absent from markets, just as public choice analysis suggests that self-interest is not so absent from government. Indeed, economists are beginning to examine the nature of economic benefits that individuals gain by participating in various networks. The issue, therefore, is not human nature, but rather how different institutions channel important aspects of human nature. Adam Smith argued that markets channel self-interest into socially beneficial directions. The public choice school of political economy argues that government institutions often channel self-interest in socially undesirable directions. But as of yet, there is no well-developed theory of how other regarding this is channeled by civil society or by government. While such a theory is not developed in TVC, the authors provide case studies to motivate such theory and to stimulate more historical study. The authors argue that the voluntary arrangements that had evolved in the past, and that in some cases are returning today, had much to offer. The welfare state did not so much create new institutions as crowd out the civic associations that people had been spontaneously fashioned to provide, public goods, safety nets, and even law and order. Were the spontaneously created institutions of the civil society better than the government institutions that replaced them? The papers in this volume cannot definitively answer this question, but remarkably they show the question is real. Private social services. Current efforts to privatize social services are nothing new. They have prominent historical precursors that provide useful lessons. In the 19th century, in both the US and Great Britain, fraternal societies provided social insurance and private schools supplied education. The same period saw the development of law and order in Britain well before the introduction of private police. Earlier precedents include the wholly private development of commercial law. Legal systems. The body of privately developed commercial law, the law merchant, as it came to be known, met the demand for commercial rulemaking and adjudication as extended trade networks evolved in medieval and early modern Europe. Individual merchant arbitrators prospered once they established a reputation for fairness. Summarizing an elaborate history, Benson notes that, in one form or another, the law merchant has operated continuously for at least 1,000 years. For much of this period, law merchant decisions were not backed by the coercive power of any court. Rather, their force came from the threat of significant boycott sanction. Benson appropriately labels his discussion as justice without government. Eventually, however, the state asserted jurisdiction in matters of commercial dispute. The rule of judges crowded out private merchant law, and lacking the commercial expertise of merchant arbitrators, the decisions of judges did not always yield a level of fairness that had come to be known. The current rise of arbitration and conflict resolution procedures indicates that here too we have come full circle. The swamped courts and their clients now welcome the competition. Nor was private law limited to civil disputes. The administration of certain aspects of criminal law had private antecedents. Davies notes the historical development of associations for the prosecution of felons, which were essentially private associations or clubs. They are just one example of the enormous range of clubs and societies set up in the course of the 18th and early 19th centuries, which met almost every imaginable human need. The need was less a product of inevitable crime that many associate with the existence of cities, but rather the criminality that accompanied rapid urbanization and associated social disruptions. Civil society found ways to maintain order that did not involve the state. Prosecution associations took advantage of the rise of newspapers and used them to advertise. Rewards were offered for information leading to the recovery of stolen goods or the prosecution of culprits. subscription lists of active members were posted with the same intent that modern neighborhood associations now post the names of private patrols engaged to inspect subscriber properties. Rewards were posted with the amounts largest if the offense was against an association member. The monopolization of crime fighting by the state, and the consequent crowding out of voluntary activity in this realm, came much later. The new police were seen as a way to fight crime and maintain political stability. In recent years, of course, the circle has been joined with the reappearance of private security firms. These are usually restricted to simply guarding property, as was not the case with their precursors. Davies notes that the boundary between state and civil society should not be taken as fixed and determinate, now or historically. Social insurance. Following the Tocqueville's celebrated discoveries of Americans' penchant for organizations, Baitu highlights the fraternal societies, including female organizations that nevertheless took the descriptor fraternal in their names, that arose during the 19th century to serve the indigent many years before the rise of the welfare state. Many of these self-help and mutual aid groups were actually sickness and life insurance orders. Their membership was in the tens of millions, an enormous army. Baitu shows that in the 20th century, many of these groups were weakened by burdensome regulation. Fewer are now poor, but many more have become dependents of the state. Baitu contrasts this with the voluntary reciprocity arrangements, characteristic of fraternal orders, that depended on and cultivated civil impulses, survival values over entitlement. They too were crowded out. The remaining fraternal orders are social organizations that no longer attend to their mutual aid functions. Green details a similar rise and fall of friendly societies in Britain and Australia. Education. Tooley shows that, before the advent of public schools, private education in England, Wales and the US was not only of high quality, but at least as widespread. The presumed trade-off of quality given up for universality achieved rests on myth. Moreover, there is no evidence that public sector intervention improved either dimension. The early successes of for-profit U.S. schools is ascribed to the forces of competition. Recent findings by Ho Xby that private schools actually benefit nearby public schools should surprise no one. Moreover, substantial evidence gathered for contemporary India shows educational entrepreneurs meeting the educational needs of the poorest in society without any help, nay, hindered by the state's obstructionism. What the situation in countries like India reveals is the extent to which the private sector can step in to cater to demand when state provision is either inadequate or non-existent. It reveals the nature of the voluntary city at its most honorable. Private initiatives and the built environment. For the case of the built environment, land markets and spontaneously developed private covenants met the challenge of the first wave of English urbanization. The common law had evolved to recognize these, allowing for flexible market-led rules of development that provided housing, which proved to be exceptionally durable. The same can be said about the rise of private places and self-governing enclaves in St. Louis. The history of private turnpike provision in the United States in the early 19th century, and the first U.S. industrial park. Developers have always recognized the importance of tie sales. Providing various infrastructures, including access, increases the value of properties they expect to bring to market. In this sense, they are, in the words of Arne, entrepreneurial planners. All entrepreneurs, and practically all people, of course, plan. We are, however, so used to associating planning of the built environment with the government-led top-down activity that Ernie's conclusions